Hi, welcome back to another episode of the DD Geopolitics podcast. We are back, me and Marant. Today we have some special guests joining us. Hopefully you guys are taking a break from the Twitter MAGA wars, which I'm actually kind of enthralled by, not choosing a side. But I think that's kept us entertained for quite some time. Marant, how are you? And how are you faring through the MAGA civil war?
The right-wing fitna, I've been enjoying it. Twitter is the land of all kinds of civil wars. You know, you have Muslim Twitter civil war. You have right-wing civil war. I love it. Yeah, I just enjoy spectating.
I do too. And today I was kind of trying to figure out the factions because, and I'm not going to mention anybody's names because I actually like them both for different reasons. They're both hilarious. But from what I can gather, the two teams are Epstein matters. We want the files. And the other side is maybe Epstein doesn't matter that much. Oh my God. Thank you so much. Crouching Realist, Hidden Groiper. Love it. Thank you, Epstein Rope Company. Anyway, perfect timing. Thank you so much. Anyway, and the other side says maybe it's really Russiagate. And I'm just not.
Yeah, basically.
I don't know how we got back to Russiagate again, but maybe we could talk about it with our guests from Moscow, Beirut. I must say Marat, Beirut area, and Chris Halali, Chris Halali from the ACP, both in Moscow right now. But why aren't they bumping up? There you go. Hi guys, how are you?
Hey, good to see you.
How are you, Chris? It's been a long time.
It's been a long time. Nice to see you. Greetings from Moscow. Greetings from the center of the multipolar world.
The multipolar world.
That's it.
So out there, the multipolar world exists. Out in the West, the multipolar world doesn't exist yet.
They still have fantasies over there.
Well, actually, this episode is really Russia heavy. So I'm kind of glad that you guys are joining us. And I definitely want both of your opinions about what's going on or what kind of the laymen are talking about in Russia, or even, I guess, the analysts. But so we'll start off with this. We've got another deadline.
One of the reasons that you're here today is to hear that we are very unhappy. I am with Russia. But we'll discuss that maybe a different day. But we're very, very unhappy with them. And we're going to be doing very severe tariffs if we don't have a deal in 50 days. Tariffs at about 100%. You'd call them secondary tariffs. You know what that means. But today we're going to talk about something else. And as you know, we've spent $350 billion approximately on this war with Russia and Ukraine. And would like to see it end. It wasn't my war. It was Biden's war. It's not my war. I'm trying to get you out of it. And we want to see it end. And I'm disappointed in President Putin because I thought we would have had a deal 2 months ago, but it doesn't seem to get there. So based on that, we're going to be doing secondary tariffs if we don't have a deal in 50 days. It's very simple. And they'll be at 100%. And that's the way it is. That can be more simple. It's just the way it is. I hope we don't have to do it.
100% secondary sanctions if they don't end the war in 50 days. What's your opinion on secondary sanctions, though? Because my general opinion is that once you start dipping into secondary sanctions, you've lost.
You know, Trump is telling us we need to be sanction maxing, right? this is the new strategy. Every time something happens, I mean, the only words he knows are tariff, sanction, and that's it. It's like that meme, you know, where it's like you receive more sanctions, I receive nothing. The 50 days is funny, you know, because there's been a good deal of criticism of this, right? Trump, formerly of the, you know, all saw this in 24 hours, also a fan of the 2 week notice, you know, famously loves to give the 2 weeks, right? Now we're at a 50 day stretch, and Ukraine is just kind of like, why are you giving them that long of a time? Like, they're going to mess us up. Like, we're taking all these punches. And so, yeah, 50 days is a decent stretch. That takes us into September 2nd, so practically like Labor Day weekend. That is a particularly interesting date. That is the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. Some people are saying that, you know, Russia will take the time to make some more gains, you know, keep on pushing further, get some more licks in on Odessa. And so, of course, the plan trusters, you know, Trump's fan base is saying that this is a bold move. This is, you know, strong and bold and courageous by Trump. To me, it seems a little skeevy and kind of slippery. It sounds like he's just sort of further offsetting this to Europe. Now, I know this is what MAGA wanted. You know, we want this to be Europe's war. Russia, from what I've seen from Russia, I mean, Lavrov seemed like they just brushed this off their shoulder. They're not really taking it that serious. But yeah, I mean, this doesn't look that strong to me from Trump's end. This by no means looks to be strong foreign policy. This looks to be like the, you know, smoke and mirrors of doing something without actually doing anything. I have to imagine that Russia looks at this as kind of a break. And so they're looking at the September 2nd date. I believe there's a sit down with Xi coming up on that date. And so they're probably going to head into that meeting, you know, feeling good. And maybe the U.S. wants to crash that party, you know, who knows? But I give this about a D minus.
D minus.
Yeah, for sure.
Wow. And you're usually
too. 50 days is, there's like wars that are completed in shorter time than that. So,
well, this war wouldn't have been completed in shorter time.
Not this one. But yeah, what do you guys think?
Wait, what about inside of Russia? Has anybody been talking about the 50 days?
Chris has been here. I just came yesterday, so I didn't really have a chance to talk to many people about it. But the ones I did talk to, I was like, what do you think about the 50 days? And everyone just like, nah, that's just Trump. Trump talking big, nothing will happen. So the general vibe is no one really cares here about his deadline. Now, what are they going to do? Most of this speculation, Russia is going to go on another offensive. Most of this is from Western media, so no one here talks about another offensive. Could be, could not be. I think they're just going to do the same, in my opinion. But yeah, Chris, you probably talked to more people about it. So
for sure. I mean, listen, the fundamental thing is that Russia is now over-sanctioned. There are sanctions and economic coercive measures up and down the entire country, hitting not only political leaders, economic leaders, academics, you name it, they got sanctions on them. But in actuality, the sanctions have failed to produce the results that I think the United States and its European partners and allies were really hoping for, which was to curtail what they saw as Russian aggression. Of course, we're seeing on the battlefield, Russia is winning day by day. More territory is liberated. The entire Luhansk People's Republic is now liberated. Donetsk People's Republic is almost close to liberation. And we're going to keep the ball moving. Of course, we have Kherson, Zaporizhia, and then we're going to keep going altogether. So it looks like, from what I'm hearing, secondary tariff measures are meant to pressure other major trading partners of Russia to try to stop Russia's current offensive, its actions to curtail them and to try to force Russia to the table. As you rightfully point out, September 2nd, that anniversary, we're going to be hopefully in China. We got an anti-fascist parade. There's going to be another military parade like May 9th. Now the Chinese are going to celebrate the victory over fascist and imperialist Japan, right, in their war, which actually was even costlier than the Great Patriotic War. So the Chinese are going to be inviting everybody over again. I cannot foresee any situation where secondary tariffs are going to push China, India, and other countries to try to force their hand with Russia. And there are so many legal and economic mechanisms that will allow all of these countries to go even to third countries to allow for the transportation of oil, natural resources, economic goods, financial exchange, everything like that. Where there's a sanction, where there's a tariff, you can get around it. And I think that's something very important to recognize here. But the Russians here are like, he's all bark, no bite. And on top of that, I think the more cynical ones understand that Trump is slowly caving to the Lindsey Graham, Mike Pompeo wing of the Republican Party. that they are starting to get a little bit of traction, that the wing that is, for example, those critical of AIPAC, those criticals of Trump's Israel policy, are the same ones that are critical of Ukraine. You can think of Marjorie Taylor Greene, but even further, you have Massey, you have everybody like that, the Tucker crowd, all that. They are very critical of what's happening. And I think that the neocons, you know, I keep saying this, this is the Trump 2.0 is revenge of the neocons. They're back in the game. And Netanyahu is a neocon himself. He's born and bred a neocon. So he has all of these people around him putting pressure. And of course, let's not be, let's be, you know, aware. Israel sees Russia as a threat as well. Okay, they have good relations. Even, you know, Putin says that Israel is a Russian-speaking country, basically, which, of course, I thought to myself, SMO 2.0, let's go already. But my thing is that, you know, there's a lot of people around Trump now that want to slowly start to change his ideas about Russia and to see it not so much as, oh, Putin, I like him. I like the parades. I like the uniforms. It's beautiful, traditional. More as it's a strategic adversary at the very lowest point, if not an outright enemy country. And so they're trying to gain that traction in the White House. We'll see. After 50 days, we're going to see what happens, because the Senate was asking for 500%, if I remember correctly. They were asking for an increase, not of 100, 500. So it was a compromise for the 100 on the secondary tariffs. We'll see if the Lindsey Grahams of Washington get what they want and get what's coming to them. But as far as here, the battle continues. The special military operation continues until victory is achieved. And of course, we remember, you have to deal with the root causes. Putin, Peskov, Lavrov, everybody keeps saying it. Zakharova, nobody listens, that the root causes need to be addressed. The root causes need to be addressed for the special military operation to end and for there to be peace and stability. If they're not addressed, we keep going.
Before we move on to our next segment, because you mentioned Israel looks at Russia as a threat, and that's going to really go well with our next segment that Murat's going to dive into. But before we get into that, I only talked to a few Russians about the actual peace talks that had been ongoing, and most of them agreed that they were just attending out of formality and kind of allowing the Americans to hang themselves. Is that kind of the overall opinion? Yeah.
Oh, of course. This is really just, it's part of the diplomatic, work of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It's part of their process. You see Lavrov, all these guys have a playbook. They have a script. It's part of the tradition. And that's just what they do. They do diplomacy. They do it very well. But is something concrete going to come out of it? No. This situation cannot be diplomatically handled, even though I think a lot of people would like it to be. This is going to be one on the battlefield.
I'm going to pass it off to Murat as we kind of dive into this very messy Azerbaijan, Russia, Israel, Ukraine, Iran, quadrahedron, or whatever it is. I don't know what it is.
Armenia, throw it all in there.
Maybe we'll even talk about Syria, but go ahead, Murat, with Armenia or Azerbaijan.
You know, real quick, Chris, I agree with you. I always say, you know, the like that quote, the moral arc of the United States is long, but it always bends towards neoconservatism. It always comes right back to that. You know,
that's
so Trump 2.0,
ain't no justice there.
They got him this time. You know, they missed on the first time, and then 2.0 they didn't miss. Exactly. So with Armenia and Azerbaijan, this is crucial. You know, the talks continue in regards to this Zangezur corridor, right? And this corridor is crucial for the relations of Azerbaijan with Turkey in the West, or its relations with Russia, right? Because everybody wants in on this deal. The corridor is going to be major. I see Azerbaijan. Isn't that a prison in Harry Potter, J.K. LOL? Very funny. Who cares? Very, very good. Very well done. The Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azerbaijan. And that prisoner is Armenia. So the Zangezur corridor, it's this major road project, right? And a trade project. And the Eurasian trade kind of hinges on this. And everyone wants to be the broker of this deal, right? And so whatever happens here, it's going to decide which way Azerbaijan's going to go. And so, you know, just over a week ago, we saw Pashinyan and Aliyev meet. We heard from Ambassador Tom Barrack discussing a U.S. proposal managing a 32-kilometer chunk of the Zangezur corridor under a 100-year lease. And under this idea, America would step in as a neutral referee, ensuring both sides get access, you know, without stepping on any toes, supposedly. It's supposed to grease the wheels for peace. And it addresses Baku's push for this secure extraterritorial route. And it'll allow Yerevan to hold on to the sovereignty kind of nominally. Pashinyan spoke on this on July 16th. He didn't necessarily say no to outsourcing the management. This is a big issue, is who's going to manage this corridor, right? Because it runs through Armenia, but they don't want to give Armenia the sovereignty over it. And there is somewhat of a precedent for this. You know, Armenia's Zvartnots airport and the South Caucasus Railway are state-owned, but they are foreign-managed. And so there is, you know, other entities within Armenia that would follow this similarly. But the issue is that this corridor could spell doom for Armenia, of course, right? And so right now we're seeing, you know, once again, a warming of relations between, not warming, they've always been warm, but they're kind of once again flirting and making Russia nervous. Turkey and Azerbaijan, of course, you know, the Turk brothers. And so there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of talk and a lot of buzz. I'm very black-pilled on it. I'm, you know, as I spoke last week on it, I've always been in the camp that, you know, Azerbaijan ultimately will stay in the Russia camp. The developments over the past couple of weeks have really changed things. I did not foresee things to get this bad. And we continue seeing in their media, you know, little shots and snips at each other between Russia and Azerbaijan. Certainly their info war game online has really ramped up, and they've not pulled any punches at all. So,
someone asked for a map.
Oh, that's okay. And so the corridor here, it would run along that border between Armenia and Iran. Iran is another entity involved here because they don't want to be left, similarly to Russia, they don't want to be left out. Every one of the major powers here does not want to be cut out of this deal because, if Turkey and Azerbaijan handle this on their own, Russia is no longer needed in the South Caucasus. And once again, if Iran is left out of this, then Iran and then Armenia is not needed for anybody. So a lot of stuff hinges on this. And, you know, as an Armenian and Azerbaijan, I'm kind of biting my nails to see as it develops. But yeah, I mean, for now, I mean, I'm placing my, if I was to have to wager money on this, it seems to me that the West is successfully picking off Azerbaijan. I do hope that Russia is able to woo them back. I would be interested to see what they're able to do that.
I disagree wholeheartedly. There is no way that Russia is going to be able to get Azerbaijan back into their camp. No way. That is gone. Aliyev is so cantankerous and antagonistic towards Russia, almost for the sake of doing it right now at this juncture. I don't think there's any going back. They brought up again, he's with Zelensky again today, talking about the plane crash, and they are filing a court case with the International Court against Russia. So, I wanted to get really deep into this because Chris is here, and I don't, this Israeli, Azerbaijani, Ukrainian, we touched on it last Sunday, this Ukrainian Azerbaijani Israeli axis forming is very weird, and I'm wondering if anybody else sees it or if they're talking about it in Russia at all, or if it's in the back of anybody's minds.
Listen, I've been talking about this for many years now. Of course, it doesn't start with just the Zangezur corridor. It goes back to Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh, right? It goes back even further to the collapse and liquidation of the Soviet Union. And even further back, it goes back centuries to the Caucasus region, the wars between Iran, between Qajar dynasty and the Tsars, and all of the treaties that gave up land, bam, boom, which part is this one, which part is that one. And you have to understand, right? You have to understand that this area, these boundaries are somewhat artificial. And they're artificial in the sense that they came most likely through ethnic cleansing, through genocide, this one, that one. Because if you go, for example, to my Iran, right? If you go to my native Iran and you go to the northern part, there are Armenian churches everywhere, for example. People were living, people were moving, communities everywhere. Everybody was mixed together, like the Turks say, turlu turlu. It was a big salad, right? Everybody was mixed. In the process of the development of nationalism and the building of nation states, everybody said, oh, wait a minute. We got to have clean states. I can't have these people there because how can they be part of my nation, right? So then you start with the war. That's why, for example, when the Soviet Union was being liquidated, basically, like you have parts of Azerbaijan at different parts because, of course, people were living in different areas. Not to mention most Azeris live in Iran, right? Azerbaijan is not a majority in terms of global Azeris. Iran is. And so that also complicates this whole situation. So I think that for us, not only the relationship between Azerbaijan and Armenia, which of course is fraught since 1991-92, and then of course you had Monty Melkonian coming, you had everybody going over. Before that you had Asala, you had all of these various movements for Armenian rights and things of that nature, especially in Turkey. After Azerbaijan becomes an independent country, you have of course this movement from within Turkey. Pan-Turkism, of course, is an old phenomenon, pan-Turanism, whatever you want to go, but it gets a new life. It gets a new breath of life because now you have, with the end of the Soviet Union, you have all of these Turkic republics springing up. And, ooh, Turkey, business is good. That's why you have, for example, this is the most strange thing for me. Çetin Dedin, you have this kind of Ottoman music playing in Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan was under Safavid dynasty. It was Shia against the Ottomans. My God, you had the Kizilbaj, you had all these groups fighting against the Ottomans. Mm-hmm. So it's just a strange phenomenon now. And I think that people need to understand that this situation is completely modern. It's completely artificial. It's something that's actually in the process year by year of getting traction and being created in front of us, right? So now you have a situation where Azerbaijan, the leadership, especially under the son, Aliyev, has become very close not only to Turkey, and they also do joint military parades together, especially after so-called conquest of Nagorno-Karabakh, sort of liberation of that territory. They had a joint parade together. It's like, well, why is Erdogan doing in Baku, right? But they were together because they see each other now as an alliance, as a sort of unbreakable bond of Turkic people. This is not true. Okay, just because you speak similar language doesn't mean anything. But their alliance naturally gravitates through Turkey to Israel. Why? Because Azerbaijan also has irredentist claims to the Iranian part of Azerbaijan as its claims. Even though Iran has claims, I saw somebody in the chat say, make Azerbaijan Iran again. Of course, for Iranian nationalists, for Persian nationalists, even I'm sure some of the monarchist crowd that are against the Islamic Republic, they see the Caucasus region as also historically belonging to their territory. So it's a very fascinating makeup here. The main thing is this: Armenia and Azerbaijan have had different roles with Russia since the creation of the Russian Federation. Of course, Armenia was closer in many ways, had a Russian military presence, and looked to Russia as a guarantor of security, and was involved in some security architecture. What ends up happening is, of course, you have the SMO, and then you have Aliyev's sort of lightning strike to try to take back, to try to wrench Artsakh from the Armenian people. You have an overnight ethnic cleansing that nobody talked about, right? It was conveniently forgotten. Ah, who cares? Armenians, they had some genocide. Well, what is this? I don't know what this is called, but... So you had this happen overnight. Nobody cared. And you know what? Everybody took notice of that because they said Russia's busy. Everybody's busy. But nobody really, there wasn't like a public outcry about this, right? Okay. Everybody tried to play the diplomatic card. Okay. Maybe it was Azeri territory after collapse. And what can we do? And they started to try to justify it, right? But this is where it's fascinating because Iran, for example, recognized Azerbaijan's right to that territory, given international law and whatever, even though Iran is diplomatically and politically much closer to Armenia. And that's why the Zengezur corridor is so important. It's the only link between, it's the only land border that Iran has with Armenia, this small section. If it's severed, now you have a U.S.-Israel aligned Azerbaijan through the entire northern part of Iran, which is very dangerous. And Iranians understand that too. Iran has been very clear diplomatically that it will not allow for a severing of its border with Armenia. Iran also has Armenian minority population representation in the Majlis and the parliament is very important for them. And Iran has an affinity towards the Armenian people. It sees it as part of a larger whole in the region. So with that understanding...
Unlike Azerbaijan, Iran actually takes care of the Armenian churches there.
Absolutely. 100%. In fact, I've seen, because of course my family in Iran, they send me sometimes these clips. People have been very critical of the Azeri government for their treatment of the churches, even saying that they're not even Shia. They are like atheists. They are, you know, against God for how they treat, because they said, how can you destroy these historic churches, monuments, the crosses, the cemeteries? How can you do it? Iran takes care of them. In fact, there are landmarks in Iran. They are protected, right? So I think that, and also there's also been this historical revisionism within Azerbaijan contemporary Azeri history to try to re-understand who the people were that actually built these churches. They're not Armenians. They're like some like proto-Turkish people who were there, you know?
It's the Caucasus Albania. They utilize the Caucasus Albania.
Of course, I'm like, we have our own problems with Albania, you know, being half Greek as well. And another episode. Do we know about Serbia and Kosovo? Let's not even get in there because it's another Balkan war.
But you mentioned the United States, and we do have a clip that even pertains to this, so I'll just throw that in there for conversation's sake, because this Azerbaijan-Armenia thing is becoming much bigger than I think that people expected to get, but this is for Murat.
Doing pretty well on Gaza. Steve Witkoff is here, and I think we could have something fairly soon to talk about. And we solved another one, that we just seem to have, Armenia and Azerbaijan. It looks like that's going to come to a conclusion, successful conclusion.
Listen, guys, I am in hell. This is my personal hell. Well, first off, did you guys catch the Azerbaijan? That sounds like a clone. It's like a clone that's being released, Azerbaijan.
So we better keep talking about Azerbaijan and Armenia so people know that they exist, I guess.
And so Chris had a lot of great points there. The small strip of land, and he's referring to the Megri corridor between Armenia and Iran. And this is extremely important for Iran, especially because if they lose that border, they are basically cut out. And once again, this is the West and all the rest of Eurasia, and these two powers to the north and to the south are cut out of the deal. You know, with the Azeris, I always say this, that Iran, believe it or not, you know, despite that being their historical daddy, you know, or whatever, that will always be their last pick now. Why? Because the existence of Azerbaijan as a nation depends on opposition to Iran, because it's their former territory. If they warm up to Iran, the fear is we're just going to become their province again. Why would we do that? You know, Russia is not going to make us be Russian. And, you know, Turkeys are, of course, you know, our Kanging brothers. But Iran is going to be the one that will just treat us like a province and try to assimilate us into a Persian culture. And, you know, Chris is exactly right that, you know, this goes back centuries. You mentioned the Qajars in Russia. I think you might even just go back to the Roman Parthian War, perhaps. I think that's
Let's go.
I think this has been the fault line between these great powers for millennia. And this is a frequent theme I like to tweet about, is the long running currents in history and how you know, many conflicts and wars today are just modern incantations of the same wars that were fought in ancient times. And so once again, this region happens to be the fault line, the line drawn in the sand between great powers, and Azerbaijan finds itself being a fulcrum. And you know, they do have this fortunate position. They have this Shia connection with Iran. They have this language connection with Turkey. There's very few countries that can say they have this personal cultural connection with two great powers. Most countries can't say that. They usually have one connection with one power. And, you know, also in the Middle East, you know, we see with Arabs how much the sectarianism matters in Arab nationalism, right? Turks, on the other hand, it's a little different. Turks have a little bit of a European-style nationalism, where it is Turk first and foremost, more so than the Sunni Shia thing. And so that is something the they really are trying.
DNA, right? How sweet it is to be a Turk, right? It's everywhere.
This is what they're trying to develop this sort of nationalism, because again, it goes back to this: we can't turn to Iran because that is the end of our nation. We need to develop this outside separate identity. And so, yeah, I mean, we're seeing a sort of constructed modern nationalism in real time working. And it is a little fake. Yeah, it's kind of fake and gay, you know, as we joke around and sort of LARPed. But it has been done effectively, you know, I must say. And so I do pray that Iran is able to pull something out. Pezeshkian, they didn't even visit in Baku, but Erdogan and Pezeshkian visited in Shusha in Karabakh. So that was certainly, you know, it was a little painful for Armenians. But at the same time, I know Iran's doing what it's got to do to politic a little bit and not be cut out of this deal.
I want to say that one of the most important story here is for the Russian Federation. This is what I've been warning about for a few years now. The Caspian Sea becoming a soft underbelly enemy territory, you know?
Well, on that note, Chris, they're starting exercises tomorrow, Russia and Iran in the
Caspian. Correct. And the reason is Russia, I think rightfully so, is very concerned that the Caspian Sea could turn into a hostile body of water. And I think that is a really serious concern. Because, of course, for those who know history, and your clip rightfully at the beginning showed some of that history, the road to the soft underbelly of the Russian Federation passed through Stalingrad, all the way cutting off the Caucasus, and then pushing up and trying to exploit all of the minorities within those territories, right? Whether it's Chechens, Dagestans, Bashkir, whoever it is, let's exploit them. And that was actually a story, funny enough, that was a story recently, was that somehow there's an underground armed movement of Bashkirs and other minorities during the SMO to try to create another front. And this was pushed in Radio Free Europe and all this stuff.
Of course.
The rationale for that is that's at that critical location, right? The southern part of Russia, the Caspian Sea, trying to exploit what's happening in Central Asia. This is Brzezinski's plan all along, right? So we have to be very careful. I think Russia rightfully understands that this situation poses an existential threat to its national security, ultimately. Because if those, example, if the Islam, you can have whatever criticism, of course, I'm Iranian, my family's there, I know all about it. You can have what criticism, but if the Islamic Republic were to fall tomorrow and you had a pro-West, pro-Israel government in Iran, heaven forbid, what would you have in the region? You would have the completion of an encirclement, basically, especially along this area. And that's very dangerous, ultimately. And so it's an ongoing question for us. Azerbaijan, Armenia, the corridor, yes, but in the bigger sense, this is ultimately against the Russian Federation and against China's Belt and Road Initiative, both of them, which pass through all of these critical territories. From the Persian Gulf to the Caspian Sea, that's the critical artery for whatever comes next in the development of a future economic order. And if you control those territories, if you control access, that changes the game.
And, you know, it kind of reminds me of the great game in the 19th century.
Absolutely.
And I saw someone in chat say, so Azerbaijan is going to be like Syria. I actually think Azerbaijan might be like Afghanistan, where it is the border of the great game. And so the encirclement Chris is talking about, I mean, absolutely. And it's a bit like that same exact strategy that, you know, the England had as it was trying to make moves in Eurasia. And today we see a similar political chessboard or geopolitical chessboard. And so Azerbaijan might actually become akin to Afghanistan. It's a little bit of a different society, but similar in the sense that these great powers are going to try to, make ends and try to exploit the various groups within it and the elites within it to hold this important fulcrum in between the powers.
Oh my God, there's like so many bazillion things I want to ask now. So, Chris, you mentioned earlier that Israel is threatened by Russia, and I kind of want to go back to that now that we've discussed all of this. I think Israel's a threat to Russia, not that Russia's a threat to Israel. Can we kind of explore this a little bit more? I want to address it because our viewers, even I myself, get frustrated with the, oh, well, there's all these Russian-speaking Israelis. There's this weird underground alliance, but really they're Ukrainian. And now they're making overtures to Zelensky while Aliyev makes overtures to Zelensky, who makes overtures to Bibi. It's just, it's kind of a mess. And do you think that Russia perceives this Israeli threat like they should?
Listen, I would say first, I think the Russians are diplomatic, but suspicious of the Israelis always. And I think that that has a historical legacy. It has a political legacy. It has a contemporary legacy with what's been going on. It's also because of Russia's close relationship with many Arab countries, who are some of its most important allies, as well as Iran in the region, right? With that, the Israelis see Russia, of course, as a threat. In what sense? Because they see Russia as a guarantor of a lot of the security for Iran, for historically Syria, of course, before last year. And also, they're the ones that allow Hamas to come for diplomatic talks in Moscow, right? So they always see Russia in a suspicious light. They say Russia plays the game, right? And of course, Russia is a diplomatic, you know, nuclear power. What can it do? It plays a diplomatic game like any country.
Right.
But even more so, Israel is very concerned about Russia's role in the Orthodox Christian politics in the Holy Land. And what do I mean by this?
Oh.
For those who don't know, because I study this, of course, you know, I went to seminary and all this stuff. And I spent time when I was in Palestine at the Patriarchate in Jerusalem. The Orthodox Church has four of the five original patriarchates, right? The five, the Pentarchy, Rome, Constantinople, Antioch, Alexandria, Jerusalem, right? Of course, Rome separated and became the Catholic Church. That's the Pope, all right? First among equals, but now they're off Pontifex Maximus, whatever. Now you have the four. The four are Orthodox, right?
Mm-hmm.
Constantinople, of course, Patriarch Bartholomew, is now very much embroiled in a schism with the Moscow Patriarchate over Ukraine because Constantinople recognized Ukraine's autocephaly, which basically means its self-rule as a church, against what has been for 400 years Moscow Patriarchate's control, right? So Alexandria aligned itself with Constantinople, leading to a breakup of a relationship between Moscow and Alexandria, because Alexandria's patriarch is Greek, like the patriarch in Constantinople. The patriarch in Jerusalem is also Greek, Theophilus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Rum, right? They call in this area of the world, it's the Rum Orthodox, because we are Romans. That's how my great grandparents referred to themselves, right? Greek nationalism is also a new invention. So for the patriarchate in Jerusalem, it has not recognized Ukraine's autocephaly and maintains very close ties with the Moscow Patriarchate. Mm-hmm. It tries to balance the relations, of course, but it tries to maintain good relations because a lot of money and power comes through the Moscow Patriarchate into the Holy Land. A lot of people go there for pilgrimage. A lot of money is spent there. A lot of important works are done there. And a lot of people left the Soviet Union and went to Israel claiming to be Jewish, but they're actually Orthodox. Convenient, right? Convenient. So in that way, it became a great game. Also in Antioch, which of course is where Syria is, right? This is the territory. Of course, it's in Turkey, but okay, the broad Syria in the historic times. Now, of course, it's based in Damascus, the patriarch there. He, of course, was close with Russia as well because of the proximity to Russia's support for Bashar al-Assad and the geopolitics of that. Now the situation is a little bit more frayed, but because of the Orthodox politics, and for those who don't know, fun fact, the Israeli parliament is built on Greek Orthodox land. The land of the Israeli Knesset is leased. It's not owned by Israel. It's leased for 100 years from the Greek Orthodox Church. So, of course, it raises a lot of concerns. After Israel, the Greek Orthodox Church is the largest landowner in this territory. So it becomes very concerning because most Greek Orthodox are Palestinians. Palestinians are Orthodox Christians. And so they see the Greek Orthodox Church in this balancing game. And the previous patriarch tried to sell land secretly to the Zionists, to a lot of these crazy groups in East Jerusalem, which would have been a future capital of a Palestinian state, right? So I want to say that it's not only the political, there's religious considerations, economic considerations that go very deep. And we're talking about a lot of power, a lot of money, you know, some Da Vinci Code type shit. But that's the root of it. And so the Moscow Patriarchate has been trying to cull and trying to take even more power in the Patriarchate in Jerusalem to have a flag there of its own, basically. And what is it doing in Africa now? I told you that Alexandria and Moscow split. In Alexandria, in the jurisdiction of the Alexandrian Patriarchate in Africa, Moscow is now opening up Russian Orthodox churches outside of the canonical jurisdiction of the Alexandrian Patriarch. Because you're not allowed to open, like I'm not allowed to open a Greek Orthodox church in Moscow without the blessing of the Patriarchate of Moscow. This is their territory, right? Mm-hmm. Now they're doing it in Africa because they don't recognize Alexandria anymore because Alexandria recognizes Ukrainian autocephaly, right? So that's how complex it is. So you have, for example, Wagner forces, you have the Russians on the ground, and you also have Orthodox priests on the ground doing the religious side of the equation.
Yeah.
And so I want people to really understand that when we talk about geopolitics, we can't forget about these dimensions. These are very important dimensions. They're at the top of a lot of these political considerations. So that's a little bit to show you the relationship between Russia, Israel, and the deeper politics that are going on behind the scenes.
You know, I have to clap for that. Sarah, have you heard a single person go into that specific angle?
No, but I didn't even want to stop him. I was so enthralled. Usually I'm like, oh my God, this is stupid.
He's 100% correct. In fact, what he's describing is actually, you know, when people wonder why are all these denominations exist in Christianity, or why were there schisms? It's for these exact issues. It's why the first Christian schism, you know, when the Assyrian or the Church of the East splits from the first churches, it's for the same reasons.
Because it was
the Christians that were within the Persian realm and outside the large Roman realm, and so they had to split off.
People forget that Orthodoxy has a nationalism inherent. Into it, it's very intertwined with the politics and the ethnicity of the nation. It's not like Catholicism where there's a central place in Rome, everybody defers to Rome. With Orthodoxy, these priests will pick up a gun. Like, they are in these movements. These churches are very much part of the national fabric. It's not like how the Catholic Church is in the United States. It's very much specific to that country.
The Catholic Church had the luxury of being off in Europe, and it was having less things going on that's going to divide it. Whereas when you have the Armenian Church, the Assyrian Church, the Coptic Church, these Oriental Orthodox churches split off first for these same political reasons. And so what he's talking about is exactly right. This issue of the recognition of an autocephalous church in Ukraine, it's crucial to all this. And so he's right. It's not just political, it's religious, it's cultural, all these things tie together. And all these things don't simply come down to theological differences. It really is just the theological differences are secondary. They're sort of emphasized because you already have the political difference and you need to emphasize and differentiate yourself.
And listen to this. I mean, you rightfully point out the Oriental, there's a split of the so-called Monophysites, right? Armenia, the Copts, the Ethiopians, the Malabarites, over one letter. Homoousios versus Homoousios. I mean, literally, if you ask any person on the street, they say it's the same word. No, this one letter led to people dying, wars being launched, entire empires being severed over one letter. So I always told my students in my theology classes, in my religious studies classes, just to show the power of a word, right? And we're still debating that word, even though, okay, for me, I recognize that Copts, Armenians, they're Ethiopian, we're all together. Like, actually, we all agree, actually. But because everybody was firmly committed to what was this word? What did he say? What did this one say? Saint Cyril, nobody wanted to move. Nobody wanted to move. And of course, you had the Byzantine hierarchy and they said, whoop, we're going to only take this position and screw everybody else. But that's the power of it. And it still persists to this day. It still persists. It has an enormous impact. Can you talk about an Armenian identity without the Armenian church?
No,
you can't. It's the only reason that the identity remains.
We got into an argument the other day because Murat said, he was like, well, if you convert to Islam, you're not Armenian anymore. And a Muslim said, what? And I was like, absolutely. That is absolutely you. That is something that is very much intertwined into the identity of an Armenian.
Why is that? Let me just say, I'm not saying that for a Kangin reason, right? Because of course, individually, some Armenian can convert to Islam and he's not going to magically morph outside of Armenianism. But what I mean by that is, if there's a community of Armenians or even a single Armenian who is Muslim, over time, they are going to assimilate outside of Armenian culture because they are not going to be incentivized to carry on anything Armenian if they are not following the Armenian church, and we know which carries on a lot of legacy Armenian traditions. If you're Muslim, you are simply assimilating into a different cultural tradition. And so, yeah, you won't change overnight, but you, if you have your kids within a generation, two generations, they are no longer going to associate themselves with Armenianness.
By the way, this is a huge debate in Armenian society. And I know this because in Worcester, Massachusetts, where I was born and raised, we have a huge, one of the first major Armenian communities, along with Watertown, all of this part in Massachusetts, right? And one of the big debates was over the Armenian Apostolic Church, right? The Orthodox Church, and the Armenian Protestants, who...
Oh.
Yeah, because of course you had this Armenian Evangelical Church, right?
I thought you were going to say the Catholic, Armenian Catholic Church, which also exists.
Yes, Armenian Catholics exist. Yes, the Eastern Rite, sort of. But you also have Armenian Protestants that exist.
Right.
And so that was a huge debate. Are you Armenian if you're Protestant? Like, because there were huge missionary efforts, right? It's a big question. It's a very big question. The same holds true for, I mean, if you're Serbian and you convert to Islam, I think you become Bosnian, right? Or if you convert to Catholic, you become Croatian, exactly. Right? I mean, think about it. This is it, right? And in the Greek sense, for example, for Greeks, it's a little bit more nuanced because we have an indigenous Greek population that was Muslim, right? Of course, a lot of them went over to Turkey, and then a lot of Turkic-speaking Orthodox Christians came over, and it was a very interesting and sometimes contentious population exchange, really. Okay, ethnic cleansing on both sides, but I think that some people to recognize that Ortho Bros, they're like, oh, you can become Orthodox and not have any national church. I don't know how you can. Maybe in the U.S. with the OCA and like some kind of like church that lost its sort of ethnic identity. But for example, in my church, we speak half the liturgy, if not more, in Greek. Like, how are you gonna like assimilate? If you want to assimilate, after the church, we have Greek dancing, Greek culture, Greek language. Everybody's speaking Greek to each other. You have to at some point enter. Can you become Serbian? Like, can you become Orthodox in a Serbian church and not take on Serbian culture? You'd have to.
Yes,
right. You'd have to, right? So I think it's important for people to understand that these, it wasn't always this way, but over time it became this way as a result of various political considerations that happened. There are differences that existed in the Catholic Church as well. And, you know, parts of the Catholic Church went to war with each other. Different parts of the empire, the Spanish, the French, blah, blah, they're all going after each other. But there was much more this universal because you had only one leader and Rome was really where it all happened. Whereas for the Orthodox, you've got patriarchs and archbishops and autocephalous churches all over. Every country basically has autocephaly basically at this point. So that's a major consideration to know.
This almost could have happened in Germany. You know, Germany is a place where you could be Catholic or Protestant, you'd still be German. But in an alternate timeline, there is a possibility where you have a Catholic German becomes an Austrian. And then the Protestant would have been up north with the Prussians. That was a possibility. It didn't quite happen that way.
A lot of that in the interwar period, for sure.
We could have ended up with that kind of timeline. But yeah, absolutely great points by Chris.
Yeah.
So where does that leave us now?
Complicated.
And we also have Syria falling apart. Because we were talking about this Turkey-Israeli-Ukrainian sort of axis forming against Iran, but then we have the issue of Syria, and Turkey and Israel do not see eye to eye on Syria. So maybe we can just give the last 10 minutes to that and kind of and end it there.
Listen, Syria is very complicated now because you have Turkey, you have the United States still has a military presence there, you have Israel, you still have two Russian bases there. You have all of this network of local militias, minority groups, blah, blah, blah. I think that the show's not over yet. I really think that, Jolani's power is not fully secure. I would not be surprised if a year or 2 years down the road, we see a partition or a further fragmentation vis-a-vis Yugoslavia of the Syrian Arab Republic into different states, right? For example, okay, yes, you know, we can criticize, rightfully so, Abdi going and making some agreement. But still, there has not been full integration of the Northeast. And still, the Kurds are holding out some hope that they will have some level of autonomy there. What that looks like, I think, depends on the U.S., depends on Israel, and depends on Turkey. And I think that Turkey would not want to see the Kurds there with any level of autonomy or any level of recognition, because in their ongoing peace agreement with the PKK and this whole you know, kind of thawing, and Öcalan coming out and speaking from İmralı and the PKK laying down its arms, they're hoping that the SDF, which is really, let's be honest, SDF, YPG, YPJ, it's all the PKK. They're hoping that they also integrate into the Syrian army and they don't have to worry about them anymore. Jolani will take care of them. But that hasn't happened yet. So I think that we haven't seen the end of this at this point. We still have a situation with the Druze, and I don't think that that thing's going to be solved anytime soon. We saw massacres, brutalities, people cutting off heads again. We're back at it again. We're back at it. I thought we had ended it, but we're back at it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we still have the massacres that took place in Latakia. You still have Christian and Alawite communities under constant threat by these roving jihadist gangs, who, by the way, are most of them are not Syrian. Mm-mm. They're Uyghurs. They're from the Caucasus. They're from Asia. They're from, who knows, Indonesia, Pakistan, Bangladesh. They all came. Everybody came, you know. So I think that the question of Syria's future, of course, for the Israelis, they would want to take territory up into maybe even including Damascus. That's their goal, their strategic goal. And then you have this David's corridor, right, that wants to go all the way to all the way up to Iraq on the border there, mm-hmm. and try to help the Kurdish forces, mm-hmm. which they see as natural allies. And this is an ongoing debate, because within the Kurdish movement, there are factions, some much more close to Iran and supportive of Iran, and others much closer to US Israel. So I think that all of this means that we're not going to have a stable Syria. We're not going to see, okay, maybe the sanctions are over, you know, in theory, but that doesn't that hasn't translated to anything material on the ground yet. What we still see on the ground are very, you know, a plethora of various factions that still exist. Not to mention, ISIS is back.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe they're not like, but their flag is there, their patches are there, the people are saying everything that they used to say. And I think that there's a very serious concern that a lot of these tensions will be exploited by neighboring countries to then have buffer zone here, buffer zone there, buffer zone there. And next thing you know, the end of Syria as we know it.
Murat, final thoughts on Syria before we close the episode so they can go to bed.
I saw that the Trump, I saw the headline about that Netanyahu's a madman.
Oh, yeah, that came out today.
I love that headline because if you guys are familiar, well, I'm sure you guys are, but for the audience, you know, Nixon's madman theory, which was, you know, the idea that, you know, you want your enemies to be like, oh, he's going crazy, or we don't know what he's going to do. But the idea of that is you're supposed to just kind of subtly signal that. But the thing is, they're so like, they try so hard that they're just doing it for Netanyahu. They're like, he's a madman. They're completely blowing the point of the madman theory by like announcing him as a madman and trying to, you know, cultivate this image. I see it as very blatantly a kind of a branding exercise, and they're sort of just assisting in the PR for them, that they're just completing the madman theory on his behalf. But yeah, it's quite nakedly transparent. A little cringy, if I may say so myself, but yeah, the headline was hilarious.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're doing this sort of, oh, they're so perturbed and bothered over Bibi's he's crazy.
He's crazy over Syria. He's not crazy over ethnically cleansing and genociding Palestinians in Gaza for 2 years.
Bombing some buildings in Damascus.
No problem. Genocide against Palestinians is normal. It's okay. They're all Hamas, even the kids, even a baby, even in the womb. But oh my God, after Syria and this and that, and oh my God, he's a madman. You see how absolutely bankrupt these people are. Absolutely morally bankrupt. I'm very happy to say, I will declare the death of liberal humanitarianism and their various interventionisms and the ideas that somehow protecting human rights and democracy and, you know, the precious children.
I got in a conversation with an Israeli, I think it was either yesterday or the day before, Marat, in a space, they were saying, we have to go in there, we have to protect the Druze. And I was like, who will protect the Gazans? And then we went back and forth for a while. And they're like, these savages are just killing the Druze and we have to stop that. And I was like, can you just say that you just want to bomb Syria? And finally they were like, we just want to bomb Syria. I was like, stop making it about humanitarianism because this is just crazy.
I hope that we can continue to do good work and continue to analyze everything that we need to. I look forward to being back with you all soon. I hope to see you all soon in person. Mm-hmm. And let's keep the struggle. We keep going. We're going to build a better world.
We all we got. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll be back either Wednesday or Sunday. Marat, say bye. Bye.